Cambridge Ideas, the podcast from Cambridge University, with ideas that transform tomorrow.
It's hard to remember a time when the two words credit crunch didn't send a shiver down our collective spine. Two words that bring with them the associations of belt tightening, plummeting share values, job losses, diminished savings, and a general sense of insecurity. But by widening our analysis of the economic situation, a group of academics at the University of Cambridge are perhaps enabling a better understanding of, and even giving us ideas for coping with, the dread of the downturn. First, there's the anthropologist, Professor Alan McFarlane.
One way of trying to think about the credit crunch is rather like a disease. I mean, this is the spots and the swellings and the lumps and so on the edge of our body, and obviously we have to go back inside and see what has caused this sort of thing.
The historian, Professor Martin Daunton.
We need to think through not simply a historical analogy, but what sort of problem needs to be fixed now by what sort of institution.
And the Wall Street trader turned senior research fellow, Dr. John Coates.
We're looking at the role of hormones, and we think economics has to start accounting for the role the body plays in economic decision-making.
The financial house of cards collapses, and the overinflated stock market plunges into a Great Depression.
Memories of the crash of 1929 were evoked at the beginning of our present crisis. There were calls for a new global order along the lines of the groundbreaking agreements at Bretton Woods in 1944. That led in turn to the founding of institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. But Professor Martin Daunton, Master of Trinity Hall and Professor of Economic History, is wary of such simplistic comparisons with the past.
The argument at Bretton Woods was that it was necessary to solve the financial difficulties of the world which had emerged in the 1930s. There was a stock market crash in 1929, and that was then followed by the imposition of protective duties by the Americans in 1930. The British followed suit with protective duties, the Germans, the Japanese. Trade is constrained. That then also leads on to a collapse of banks. Now, Second World War comes along, and what the British and the Americans wanted to do during the war was to restart that international credit system, which meant the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and making it safe to lend to each other. So this was kick-starting, they hoped, the whole of the world financial system again. So Gordon Brown says, we need second Bretton Woods. We're going to do exactly the same now in 2009 as Roosevelt and Churchill did in 1944. It's misguided. Bretton Woods won, the Bretton Woods in 1944, only worked because it was in the middle of a world war and it was only two actors, Britain and America, decided what they wanted to do, and then 44 countries met in 1944. And they all signed up to the deal. Easy. In the middle of a world war, that was possible to do. But this is, I think, a way of being misled, because history does not repeat itself. History is not something from which one simply learns lessons. Each historical episode is different. I think mainly analogy is being used for rhetoric to try and convince the public that you know what you're doing. I'm afraid as a historian, it gives me a lack of confidence that they know what they're doing. Simply by reaching for the shelf and saying, we could have a new Bretton Woods, is not the answer. We need to think, what sort of institutions can be created now, given the political circumstances of the world? And moreover, think through what type of international institution is needed. The real issue now is how to control global flows of capital. And how does one do that? That might require going out to talk to scholars from different disciplines, whether it be politics or divinity. You know, we might need to understand different ways in which different religions view credit.
Much of the blame for our current situation has been laid at the feet of the over-greedy sectors of the financial markets. The rogue traders and speculators were simply out of control, say the critics, fuelled by a high adrenaline bonus culture. Dr. John Coates is a research fellow in neuroscience and finance. He's uniquely placed to look at this area. In the not-too-distant past, he was that frenetic trader on Wall Street. Now he's part of the team at Judge Business School, analysing the hormone profile of city traders and trying to find the link between chemical changes in their bodies and the economic cycle of boom and bust.
I was running a trading desk on Wall Street during the dot-com bubble. During that time, I noticed amongst the traders on the floor, amongst other traders on Wall Street, what I noticed is that they were displaying what might be called classic clinical symptoms of mania. They were delusional, they were euphoric, they were overconfident, they had racing thoughts, diminished need for sleep. It was strange behavior. As I say, it was clinical behavior and it seemed like mania. What's more, these people weren't disposed to that sort of behavior. They weren't acting that way before the bubble and they weren't acting that way after it crashed. After it crashed, they behaved like people with a hangover. So I began to suspect that maybe there was a chemical involved. There was another fact at the time that struck me and led me to ask some questions, and that was the fact that women seemed relatively unaffected by the frenzy. I figured I was on the trail of a molecule, a chemical, that affected men more than women. During that time, I had met some neuroscientists up at Rockefeller, and I came across a model that had been tested in a number of different animal species called the winner effect. In the winner effect, two male animals come together in a confrontation, either for turf or a mate or food or whatever. And in preparation for this confrontation or this fight, their testosterone levels rise. The winner comes out of this confrontation with even higher levels of testosterone. He gets a boost up in his T levels, while the loser has lower testosterone levels. What's interesting about the model is the end game, so to speak. As the testosterone levels rise in the bodies of these animals, they become not only confident and have a greater appetite for risk, they become overconfident and their assessment of risk becomes impaired. These animals start going out in the open too much. They pick too many fights. They neglect parenting duties. They patrol areas that are too large. And as a result, they suffer an increased rate of predation. Here was a beautiful model for how winning could increase your confidence and risk preferences until eventually you were taking on too much confidence and becoming overconfident. And I thought, that's what's happening to these traders. So that was the hypothesis that we wanted to test. I went back to Cambridge, and being a former trader, it was easy for me to get back onto a trading floor. And we set about testing this hypothesis by taking salivary steroid samples from a group of traders over a period of time to see how their steroids reacted to them making and losing money.
The team have already isolated two crucial steroids in the bodies of city traders: cortisol and, perhaps not surprisingly, testosterone.
We think that the testosterone was implicated in exaggerating a bull market to such an extent that it turns into a bubble. We were also looking at another steroid called cortisol, which is the stress hormone. Cortisol, as a stress hormone, if it stays elevated for a length of time, it has terrible effects on the body and brain. Chronically elevated levels of cortisol change the sorts of memories you recall. You tend to recall mostly negative precedents, bad things that have happened in the past in similar situations. You tend to see risk where none may exist, and you feel anxious. So we had these two steroids that we thought were building up in the bodies of traders systematically and exaggerating risk preferences across the business cycle. So they were making the peaks higher and the lows lower. In accordance with the winner effect model, we found that when traders made an above-average gain trading during the day, they had above-average levels of testosterone at the end of the day. The more intriguing finding was that when traders had high levels of testosterone in the morning, they went on to make a lot more money for the rest of the day. What we found with cortisol was slightly different. We were expecting cortisol to go up when traders lost money. In fact, what we found was that there was a much stronger effect, and that was coming from uncertainty. Cortisol, it's known, rises most strongly when animals or humans are put in a situation of great uncertainty. They don't know what's going to happen. Their cortisol spikes up in preparation of the unknown. When the volatility of the market increases, uncertainty increases, and we found that cortisol levels were rising enormously under those circumstances. We also found that cortisol levels went up markedly when the variance of their trading results went up. The effect size, again, was enormous. During our sampling times, we should have seen both testosterone and cortisol dropping about 50%. On some days, we saw traders' cortisol levels rise 500%. So these were enormous steroid movements in these traders. What this means for today? Well, I think the volatility both in the market and in traders' P&Ls over the past year and a half in this credit crisis, volatility has been so high that we're pretty sure that the cortisol levels of the traders would be quite elevated. And this may help explain why they are so risk-averse at the moment. And so we think that right now cortisol may be playing a role in exaggerating the extent of risk aversion in the financial system. So the way economic agents, traders, investors, interpret information, economic statistics, really depends on which steroids are in the ascendant. When our first paper was published, I got email or phone calls from a lot of traders saying, I now know what's going on when I make a lot of money and then do something so stupid to give it all back. I can't figure out why I did it afterwards. And it's like those animals who are going out in the open too much or picking too many fights. There's a day of reckoning. And the possibility exists that stock market bubbles are a male phenomenon. And if that is the case, then the way to dampen volatility in the financial world is to have more women and older men on the trading floors.
Alan McFarlane is Professor of Anthropology at King's College, Cambridge. Since the onset of the credit crunch, he's become particularly interested in the human interaction which occurs during the process of trading. Specifically, he points to the often dangerous gap which develops between our known capabilities and the virtual nature of the economy. According to him, it leads to a loss of connection, and what we need is a touch of reality to bring us back to believing in old-fashioned values of security and trust.
The world economy will not work without these huge amounts of credit floating around. It would just seize up. We need that. On the other hand, it cannot be secured. All attempts of governments like the United States and elsewhere to pump money into the economy or to say that they will guarantee the banks and so on are so many words. They really cannot guarantee or back up this amount of money. It's virtual money and it's virtual credit. It doesn't really exist, and it's only in our minds. And as soon as our minds say it doesn't really exist, it's like Tinkerbell. As soon as the children stopped believing in Tinkerbell, she died. And as soon as we stop believing in this stuff, it dies. So basically all it rests on, and has done for some time, is trust.
Trust as a concept, and indeed as an institutional form in itself, has, argues Alan McFarlane, been vital to British and American culture for centuries. Now the challenge is to redefine that trust.
The trust originally was a financial device to avoid paying large sums of money to the king, to avoid inheritance duties. And so you set up a trust, which is a group of people who would look after your estate, and when you died they would pass it on to someone else. And it started in a very restricted way. And Henry VIII realized that this was a threat to the state because they were losing revenues, and he tried to get rid of it, but he failed. And it then formed the basis for most of the institutions that made the modern world. For instance, the nonconformist sects, the small religious groups which brought us religious freedom, like the Methodists and the Quakers, were set up as trusts so they could avoid being destroyed by the Catholic or Anglican powers. So modern religious freedom comes out of the trust and the trusting idea. The major financial institutions, the Bank of England, the Stock Exchange, Lloyd's Insurance, were set up as a trust and remained trusts. But it then has another effect outside the actual institutions which it spawns, which is that if you act in this way in these groups and associations, you then find yourself thinking and trusting. It builds up an atmosphere of trust. One of the oddnesses of English social structure and American social structure has been that it's always been very trusting. A person's word is their bond. And this has grown up for centuries in this country, but it's rather unusual when you compare it to other places. A lot of capitalism is based on that, because you haven't got time and you have to trust the other person. Someone says, invest in that, and you trust them. You trust your stockbroker and so on. As we're talking, I'm beginning to wonder whether credit should be replaced by trust. It's not the credit crunch, it's a trust crunch. I suppose perhaps one of the difficulties now is that each civilization, as it grew up, had patterns of ensuring stable relations and trust, but they're all rather different. And again, globalization in the last 10 or 15 years has meant that they've all suddenly had to mesh together. The other problem now is with the economic system of the world gone global and totally seamless and interconnected, the political system hasn't. And there is no proper international legal system. Therefore, if you get people reneging between disparate regimes of trust in different countries, who are you going to appeal to? There's no redress at all because there's no international court of chancery, so to speak, to sue them in. So until we really come to terms with the fact that the economic growth has really outstripped our political and legal growth in this world, this sort of thing is likely to continue.
That is what you're trying to do, Mr. Keynes, isn't it? Yes, it's obvious that we must work harder, more men and women in employment and longer overtime.
In the Keynesian model, which was at the basis of those Bretton Woods meetings, we were to spend our way out of a crisis. But with the debt figures heading deeper and deeper into the red, that is clearly no longer an option. According to Professor McFarlane, consuming more is a thing of the past.
I imagine that what we will all have to do is to reassess the patterns of our lives, for example, to spend less on consuming physical things like food and clothes and so on, and then more on consuming non-physical things like beauty and art. Gradually one has to re-examine, and I think this is already beginning to happen. A lot of people are moving from extreme consumerism towards searching for interesting things to do, to, you know, arts and games and sports and designing, and all sorts of things. A lot of this kind of activity is actually collaborative and cooperative.
That was Professor Alan McFarlane, and you've been listening to Cambridge Ideas, the podcast from the University of Cambridge.